Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. An antibody cocktail treatment for COVID-19 that neutralizes the coronavirus has been approved for use by the UN Health Agency, it announced on Friday. New guidelines from the World Health Organization, WHO, specify the two types of patients who should receive the therapy Regeneron. The first are those infected with coronavirus who are at a high risk of hospitalization. The second are those who are already very sick in hospital and who have not mounted their own antibody defense. WHO's Dr. Janet Diaz described the development as a major breakthrough in the care of COVID-19 patients, which followed a major UK trial. She also expressed hope that negotiations with the manufacturer Roche would lead to the widespread availability of Regeneron.
It is true right now there is limited availability and the cost is high for this monoclonal antibody cocktail. However, with this new recommendation, we know that the life-saving benefits and the benefits for patients with COVID-19 is significant and requires action.
Regeneron is only the third treatment to be approved by the WHO. In July, it backed the use of so-called receptor blockers in severely ill patients to stop their immune systems from overreacting to coronavirus. The blocking drugs work particularly well with corticosteroids, which WHO recommended in September 2020. To Belarus now, where the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights said on Friday that she continues to be alarmed by persistent allegations of widespread and systematic torture of protesters. Severe restrictions on people's fundamental freedoms have also continued since the disputed re-election of President Alexander Lukashenko in August last year, Michelle Bachelet told the Human Rights Council in Geneva. She highlighted ongoing police raids against civil society groups and independent media, and the politically motivated arrests and criminal prosecutions of activists and journalists. More than 650 people are believed to be in prison because of their opinions, including the head of the well-known human rights group, Vyazna. The UN rights chief said that as of the 10th of August 2021, 27 journalists and media workers remain in detention. They include Raman Pratasevich, who was arrested in May after his flight from Greece to Lithuania was diverted to Belarus. An Afghan female politician who fled Kabul last month has insisted that the Taliban must allow women to play a meaningful part in Afghanistan's future. Speaking at an NGO event in Geneva, Zarifa Ghaffari said that poverty, violence and fear had increased in the country since the Taliban takeover on the 15th of August. She regretted that the de facto rulers had not appointed a single woman to their interim cabinet, but said that she remained determined to speak to the Taliban on behalf of all Afghan women.
I want to talk to them on behalf of all women of Afghanistan who have been already paid a big amount of prices for the war or maybe for the peace. So now they are just lost. We are not the woman of 2001. We are not the woman of 90s. If they really want to govern and lead in Afghanistan, they are not able to govern without 50% of Afghanistan, which are women.
Ms. Ghaffari said she was particularly concerned about the future of girls and women now that women are just forced to stay at home and girls are told not to go to school. Katie Dartford, UN News.
Hello, in this week's show, UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres on Afghanistan and other big problems that need an international effort to fix them. Details from UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet on Myanmar's spiral of violence and corruption in South Sudan that's impacting terribly on the country's people, although there is a little bit of good news from there too, as we'll hear. That's all coming up in this week's UN Catch-Up Dateline Geneva. Thanks for listening. First, the news with Katie Dartford.
This is news in brief from the United Nations. Afghanistan's health system is on the brink of collapse, the head of the World Health Organization, WHO, has warned. Speaking from Kabul on Wednesday after a meeting with senior Taliban figures, along with medical professionals and patients, WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said that international funding cuts had forced health providers to decide who to save and who to let die. The development came as the UN's Emergency Relief Chief Martin Griffiths announced he was releasing $45 million to support Afghanistan's crumbling healthcare system. In rural areas, meanwhile, the UN Food and Agricultural Organization called for urgent international assistance to safeguard livelihoods. Farmers need seeds for the coming winter wheat season, a mainstay for food security and livelihoods, and a source of more than half of the average daily calorie intake in the country. Violence that has rocked Myanmar following a military coup in February shows alarming signs of escalating into a widespread civil war, UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet has warned. At the Human Rights Council in Geneva on Thursday, Ms. Bachelet said that clashes occur regularly between civilian fighters and government forces in many areas of the country where conflict has not been seen in generations. At the same time, the state military, known as the Tatmadaw, has conducted offences in Magwe and Sagaing regions and in Chin State, reportedly killing villagers and burning houses, the High Commissioner said.
I appeal once again to all armed actors to respect human rights and ensure that civilians and civilian structures are protected. Use of airstrikes and artillery in residential areas and any form of military operation that targets health centres, places of worship, schools or other protected structures must immediately cease.
Presenting a new report on Myanmar to the Council, Ms. Bachelet explained that it details many serious violations on human rights and international humanitarian law. Several of these violations may amount to crimes against humanity or war crimes, she added. Staying with the Human Rights Council, which has heard how a peaceful future for South Sudan continues to be plagued by violence and corruption, delivering an update to the forum in Geneva, Deputy UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Nada Al-Nashis, highlighted staggering levels of localized violence. She attributed this to community-based militias who were responsible for almost all killings, injuries, abductions, and sexual violence between April and June this year. According to the UN mission in South Sudan, the three-month period saw 585 people killed, 305 injured and thousands forcibly displaced throughout the country, particularly in Jonglei and the Greater Pibor Administrative Area. In addition to its human rights work, UNMISS also promotes good relations between South Sudan's ethnic groups. On Tuesday, it unveiled a community centre where it plans to host peace discussions. Here's local resident Alice Charles from Yambio in western Equatoria State.
We appreciate UNMISS for constructing this peace center for us. We are eager for peace in our country. We have suffered enough conflict, running from place to place in fear of our lives. Our children are suffering. We really need a durable peace.
Also reporting to the Human Rights Council in Geneva, the Commission of Human Rights in South Sudan maintained that South Sudan's leaders have continued to divert staggering amounts of money from the country's public coffers and resources. The result has been to undermine human rights and endanger people's security in the country, the Commission said, after finding that more than $73 million has been siphoned off since 2018. Katie Dartford, UN News.
Thanks to Katie Dartford for the news, and now to New York, where country presidents and prime ministers have been attending the slimmed-down UN General Assembly, the biggest annual multilateral gathering in the world. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has had a hug from at least one leader, but it's not all warm embraces, as the UN chief told the organization's 193 member states that they're being too slow in sorting out the world's existential climate crisis. It's code red for humanity, he said. But there's other urgent problems to deal with, not least Afghanistan, since the Taliban takeover on the 15th of August. Here he is talking about the UN's priorities in the country with UN News' Assumpta Massoi.
The situation is unpredictable, and our duty is to engage. To engage based on what we can deliver, and what we can deliver is essentially humanitarian aid at the present moment, and to engage in order to explain to the Taliban how important it is for them to have an inclusive government of all the different ethnicities. Women must be able to work, girls must be able to have all levels of education, and at the same time to cooperate with the international community fighting terrorism in an effective way. And then we need to mobilize the international community to provide humanitarian aid.
Why do you hold this strong conviction that multilateralism is the only sure way forward for our world today?
Well, look what has happened to our world. A virus has defeated the world. More than 1 year and a half after everything started, we still have the virus spreading everywhere. Mm-hmm. And we see a dramatic impact on the lives of people.
a dramatic increase of inequalities, economies in extremely difficult situations, and of course the most vulnerable suffering enormously. We need to solve the problem multilaterally, mm-hmm. bringing everybody together, mm-hmm. but we need to have multilateral institutions with a stronger capacity of governance in order to be able to prevent and in order to be able to solve the challenges that we face. And if we talk about climate, mm-hmm. it is the same. Mm-hmm. We are on the verge of the abyss, and the truth is that the objective very clearly fixed by the scientific community that temperature should not go above 1.5 degrees until the end of the century. We are risking not to be able to do it because countries are not cooperating among themselves. There is a lot of mistrust between developed countries, developing countries. There is a north-south divide that is making it difficult for all to assume commitments to reduce emissions in order to have a drastic reduction in the next decade or to reach carbon neutrality in 2050. So we need a strengthened multilateralism.
What actions do you wish to see implemented to ensure that gender equality is a reality by 2030?
This is a question of power. Power today in the world is still essentially concentrated on men. And we need the men that understand that only with full gender equality the world will improve and the problems will be solved. We need those men to engage effectively in the fight for gender equality. We need to have women and men in full equality where decisions are taken.
You've warned recently that events in Afghanistan could also influence what happens next in certain volatile hotspots in Africa in particular, where extremist ideology is driving conflict. Could you please explain how you see this?
I think one looks at a situation like the Sahel, I'm very worried. And we see the terrorist groups emboldened by the situation in Afghanistan, the victory of the Taliban. I think it's time to really rally efforts to make sure that we create an effective security mechanism in the Sahel. That is why I've been always advocating for a strong African force by the African Union together with regional organizations, mm-hmm. with support from the Security Council and the Chapter 7 resolution, and with contributions, mandatory contributions, to guarantee that that force will be effectively supported. But then we also know that a military force is not enough. We need to have development, we need to fight the impact of climate change, and we need to do everything to improve the governance of the area. So we need really to boost our efforts, and I appeal the international community to fully support it in the different dimensions, in the security dimension, in the development dimension, in the humanitarian dimension, in the governance and human rights dimension. And if we do it, we will be able to defeat terrorism in the Sahel. Then the same can be said about other parts of Africa.
What more can the UN do to make the world a more secure place?
Well, the biggest problem today is the lack of trust, and especially the lack of trust among the big powers. You see that in the difficulties of the Security Council to take adequate decisions mm-hmm. to address the different crises in the world. And with this division, with this divide among the big powers, with this lack of trust, what we see is an environment of impunity. People think they can do whatever they want. Mm. So we need to rebuild trust among those that have more influence in world affairs to be able to cooperate in order to make sure that we are able to unite the international community in addressing the crises that are multiplying now.
Now the general debate is next week, Mr. Secretary General. Do you have any message, or what is your key message to the world leaders as they are coming next
week? Well, my main message is it's time to ring the alarm bell. We are on the verge of a precipice, and we are moving in the wrong direction. Look at the vaccination. Look at the difficulties in bringing together all countries to make sure that we make COP26 a success. Look at the multiplication of conflicts we have witnessed in the last few months. We need to change course, and we need to wake up. So my message to the leaders, wake up, change course, unite, and let's try to defeat the enormous challenges we are facing today.
Thanks to Assumpta Massoi there from New York for interviewing the Secretary General. On Wednesday, he welcomed new climate action commitments by Presidents Xi and Biden that the US is to significantly increase climate financing to $11.4 billion a year. Remember, we want to see developed countries spend $100 billion a year on this. And also that China will stop financing coal-fired power plants abroad and redirect its support to green and low-carbon energy. But there's no time to be complacent, as we know, because, as the UN chief said, based on present national emissions reduction commitments, the world is on a catastrophic pathway to 2.7 degrees of heating. We need decisive action. And that's why I'm turning to regular guest Solange Beautegui-Cortez for the answers. Actually, that's a big ask, isn't it, Solange? So just your thoughts, really, on how we can keep this 1.5-degree goal of the Paris Agreement within reach. Hi, Solange.
Hola, Daniel. Arus kiptasip hanyanaka sakipunira kispawa. Do you remember this Aymara word, Daniel?
I do.
One day you will say it. It's one of the longest words in the world, with 36 letters and 14 syllables. It means we are compelled to communicate. For me, this unique word captures the spirit of the indigenous people, but it also represents the vision of the United Nations. We are all in this together. It is an inspiration for multilateralism. And as the Secretary General Antonio Guterres just said, multilateralism is the only solution. It has become a necessity to deal with multiple global crises we are experiencing: climate change, gender inequality, pandemics, war. Afghanistan is living dark and silent days. As we said in a recent podcast, women and even birds have lost the will to sing. The only hope of giving them back their voices is to show that the multilateral face of the world can produce results. The path will be as long as the Aymara word, but communication opens windows to dialogue between different cultures. Sometimes each person is a country, diverse, complex, contradictory. Fernando Pessoa was a remarkable Portuguese poet with a multitude of literary identities. Each of us is a multitude of selves, he thought. He believed life is a constant conversation among our different identities. I recall the title of one of his books, O Livro do Desassossego, The Book of Disquiet. As long as women in Afghanistan cannot study like men, as long as they do not come out of the shadows without having their identities oppressed, all women in the world will live in a permanent state of disquiet, desassossego. In the last few weeks, Afghan women have lost 20 years of small victories. The road will be long and we have to find common paths, but multilateralism is the infinite discussion in a lifetime of conversation.
Yes, Solange, agreed. And thank you so much for that poetic reference as ever. The theme of talking and of peace and compromise has been on many people's minds here at UN Geneva this week, where the annual peace talks took place on Tuesday, which was the International Day of Peace. I met the former Afghan mayor, Zarifa Ghaffari, who recently fled the country, and she told me that she wants to talk to the Taliban and represent all women in her country. We'll hear more from her next week. That's all we have time for now. My thanks to you, Solange, for your comments, Katie Dartford too for reading the news, and you listeners. Don't forget, if you want more headlines, stories and interviews, just check out UN News. We'll be back next week. Bye-bye for now.
Hasta pronto, Daniel. Hasta pronto a todos y a todas.
Hello again. Before I sign off, here's news of a brand new audio series you might like. It's the UN Climate Podcast, No Denying It. It features young climate changemakers from across our warming planet who show us how we can make a positive impact in our daily lives. Listen in wherever you get your podcasts every Thursday from the 26th of August.
Young people, from the first time in several centuries, they don't believe that their life will be better than their father's.
There's no denying it. Stopping climate change is simple. We need to stop digging up fossil fuels and burning them just to get energy.
Our current climate crisis is directly linked to colonization when we think of colonization as a system that's always thinking about extraction.
It's hard to focus on individual rights or our wealth inequality if literally they can't breathe the air, or there's fires pushing them out of their communities or their home.
Quitting our addiction to fossil fuels is going to take solutions in every industry, at every scale, in every nation on the planet.
It's not because of CO2. It's because we approached the planet with an unbalanced worldview. And so, of course, eventually the world became unbalanced. So if we can take some lessons and teachings from indigenous cultures, if we as individuals can hold a balanced view in our minds, then it's just a matter of time before the world balances as well.
Our vision is to be able to replicate this process in every part of the world that there is sea and fishermen.
It made you understand your place better, made you feel really humble and want to work a lot to preserve the well-being of this planet that has existed so many ages.
No denying it, the UN Climate Action Podcast brings you the voices of young climate changemakers from across our warming planet. These activists, engineers, and entrepreneurs show us how we can make big changes in our homes, our jobs, where we vote and pray, and with our family and friends.
I believe everyone is put in this world for a purpose. And my purpose was always to create a dent in the universe by impacting the environment space. That is my purpose.
We all have to start somewhere, but the important thing is to get started. There's no denying it. Find No Denying It, the United Nations Climate Action Podcast, wherever you listen.
This is News in Brief from the United Nations. Violence that has rocked Myanmar following a military coup in February shows alarming signs of escalating into a widespread civil war, UN Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet has warned. At the Human Rights Council in Geneva on Thursday, Ms. Bachelet said that clashes occur regularly between civilian fighters and government forces in many areas of the country where conflict has not been seen in generations. At the same time, the state military, known as the Tatmadaw, has conducted offences in Magwe and Sagaing regions and in Chin State, reportedly killing villagers and burning houses, the High Commissioner said.
I appeal once again to all armed actors to respect human rights and ensure that civilians and civilian structures are protected. Use of airstrikes and artillery in residential areas and any form of military operation that targets health centres, places of worship, schools or other protected structure must immediately cease.
Presenting a new report on Myanmar to the Council, Ms. Bachelet explained that it details many serious violations on human rights and international humanitarian law. Several of these violations may amount to crimes against humanity or war crimes, she added. To rural Afghanistan now, where 70% of the country's population lives and where many now face a dramatic rise in hunger levels, the UN Food and Agricultural Organization has warned. In an appeal for urgent assistance from the G20 group of nations, FAO Chief Qu Dongzhu insisted that supporting safeguarding rural livelihoods must be a priority. Farmers need seeds for the coming winter wheat season, a mainstay for food security and livelihoods, and a source of more than half of the average daily calorie intake in the country. Failure to speed up efforts immediately to support and salvage rural agricultural livelihoods will lead to enormous increases in hunger and malnutrition, massive displacement and vast increases in acute humanitarian situations going into the winter season, Mr. Qu said late on Wednesday. He was speaking at a virtual meeting of the ministers for foreign affairs of the G20 countries, including Spain as a permanent guest, the Netherlands and Singapore as guests, and Qatar. Staying with the Human Rights Council, which has heard how a peaceful future for South Sudan continues to be plagued by violence and corruption. Delivering an update to the forum in Geneva, Deputy High Commissioner for Human Rights, Nada Al-Nashif, highlighted staggering levels of localized violence. She attributed this to community-based militias who were responsible for almost all killings, injuries, abductions, and sexual violence between April and June this year. According to the UN mission in South Sudan, the three-month period saw 585 people killed, 305 injured and thousands forcibly displaced throughout the country, particularly in Jonglei and the Greater Pibor Administrative Area. In addition to its human rights work, UNMISS also promotes good relations between South Sudan's ethnic groups. On Tuesday, it unveiled a community centre where it plans to host peace discussions. Here's local resident Alice Charles from Yambio in western Equatoria State.
We appreciate UNMISS for constructing this peace center for us. We are eager for peace in our country. We have suffered enough conflict, running from place to place in fear of our lives. Our children are suffering. We really need a durable peace.
Also reporting to the Human Rights Council in Geneva, the Commission of Human Rights in South Sudan maintained that South Sudan's leaders have continued to divert staggering amounts of money from the country's public coffers and resources. The result has been to undermine human rights and endanger people's security in the country, the Commission said, after finding that more than $73 million has been siphoned off since 2018. Katie Dartford, UN News.
Mr. President of the General Assembly, Excellencies, I'm here to sound the alarm. The world must wake up. We are on the edge of an abyss and moving in the wrong direction. Our world has never been more threatened or more divided. We face the greatest cascade of crises in our lifetimes. The COVID-19 pandemic has supersized the glaring inequalities. The climate crisis is pummeling the planet. Upheaval from Afghanistan to Ethiopia to Yemen and beyond has thwarted peace. A surge of mistrust and misinformation is polarizing people and paralyzing societies. Human rights are under fire and science is under assault. And economic lifelines for the most vulnerable are coming too little and too late, if they come at all. Solidarity is missing in action just when we need it most. Perhaps one image tells the tale of our times. The picture we have seen from some part of the world of COVID-19 vaccines in the garbage, expired and unused. On the one hand, we see the vaccines developed in record time, a victory of science and human ingenuity. On the other hand, we see that triumph undone by the tragedy of lack of political will, selfishness and mistrust. A surplus in some countries, empty shelves in others. A majority of the wealthier world vaccinated, over 90% of Africans still waiting for the first dose. This is a moral indictment of the state of our world. It is an obscenity. We passed the science test, but we are getting an F in ethics. Excellencies, the quiet alarm bells are also ringing at fever pitch. The recent report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change was a code red for humanity. We see the warning signs in every continent and region. Scorching temperatures, shocking biodiversity loss, polluted air, water and natural spaces, and climate-related disasters at every turn. As we saw recently, not even this city, the financial capital of the world, is immune. Climate scientists tell us it is not too late to keep alive the 1.5-degree goal of the Paris Climate Agreement. But the window is rapidly closing. We need a 45% cut in emissions by 2030. Yet, a recent UN report made clear that with present national climate commitments, emissions will go up by 16% by 2030. That would condemn us to a hellscape of temperature rises of at least 2.7 degrees above pre-industrial levels. A catastrophe. Meanwhile, the OECD just reported a gap of at least $20 billion in essential and promised climate finance to developing countries. We are weeks away from the UN climate conference in Glasgow, but seemingly light years away from reaching our targets. We must get serious and we must act fast. Excellencies, COVID and the climate crisis have exposed profound fragilities as societies and as a planet. Yet instead of humility in the face of these epic challenges, we see hubris. Instead of the path of solidarity, we are on a dead end to destruction. At the same time, another disease is spreading in our world today, a malady of mistrust. When people see promises of progress denied by the realities of their harsh daily lives, when they see their fundamental rights and freedoms curtailed, when they see petty as well as grand corruption around them, when they see billionaires joyriding to space while millions go hungry on Earth, when parents see a future for their children that looks even bleaker than the struggles of today, and when young people see no future at all. The people we serve and represent may lose faith not only in their governments and institutions, but in the values that have animated the work of the United Nations for over 75 years. Peace, human rights, dignity for all, equality, justice, solidarity. Like never before, core values are in the crosshairs. A breakdown in trust is leading to a breakdown in values. Promises, after all, are worthless if people do not see results in their daily lives. Failure to deliver creates space for some of the darkest impulses of humanity. It provides oxygen for easy fixes, pseudo-solutions, and conspiracy theories. It is kindling to stoke ancient grievances, cultural supremacy, ideological dominance, violent misogyny, the targeting of the most vulnerable, including refugees and migrants. Excellencies, we face a moment of truth. Now is the time to deliver. Now is the time to restore trust. And now is the time to inspire hope. And I do have hope. The problems we have created are problems we can solve. Humanity has shown that we are capable of great things when we work together. And that is the raison d'etre of our United Nations. But let's be frank. Today's multilateral system is too limited in its instruments and capacities in relation to what is needed for effective governance of managing global public goods. It is too fixed on the short term. We need to strengthen global governance. We need to focus on the future. We need to renew the social contract. And we need to ensure a United Nations fit for a new era. That is why I presented my report on our common agenda in the way I did. It provides a 360-degree analysis of the state of our world with 90 specific recommendations that take on the challenges of today and strengthen multilateralism for tomorrow. Our common agenda builds on the UN Charter, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development, and the Paris Climate Agreement. It is in line with the mandate I was given by the UN 75 Declaration to seek a pathway to a better world. But to reach that land of our promises, we must bridge great divides. Excellencies, I see six great divides, six grand canyons that we must bridge now. First, we must bridge the peace divide. For far too many around the world, peace and stability remain a distant dream. In Afghanistan, where we must boost humanitarian assistance and defend human rights, especially of women and girls. In Ethiopia, where we call on parties to immediately cease hostilities, ensure humanitarian access, and create the conditions for the start of an Ethiopian-led political dialogue. In Myanmar, where we reaffirm unwavering support to the people in their pursuit of democracy, peace, human rights, and the rule of law. In the Sahel, where we are committed to mobilizing international assistance for regional security, development, and governance. In places such as Yemen, Libya, and Syria, where we must overcome stalemates and push for peace. In Israel and Palestine, where we urge leaders to resume a meaningful dialogue, recognizing the two-state solution as the only pathway to a just and comprehensive peace. In Haiti and so many other places left behind, where we stand in solidarity through every step out of crisis. Excellencies, we are seeing an explosion in seizures of power by force. Military coups are back. And the lack of unity among the international community does not help. Geopolitical divisions are undermining international cooperation and limiting the capacity of the Security Council to take the necessary decisions. A sense of impunity is taking hold. And at the same time, it will be impossible to address dramatic economic and developed challenges while the world's two largest economies are at odds with each other. Yet I fear our world is creeping towards two different sets of economic, trade, financial and technological rules, two divergent approaches in the development of artificial intelligence, and ultimately, the risk of two different military and geopolitical strategies. And this is a recipe for trouble. it would be far less predictable than the Cold War. To restore trust and inspire hope, we need cooperation, we need dialogue, we need understanding. We need to invest in prevention, peacekeeping and peace building. We need progress on nuclear disarmament and in our shared efforts to counter terrorism. We need actions anchored in respect for human rights, and we need a new comprehensive agenda for peace. Excellencies, second, we must bridge the climate divide. This requires bridging trust between North and South. It starts by doing all we can now to create the conditions for success in Glasgow. We need more ambition from all countries in three key areas: mitigation, finance, and adaptation. More ambition on mitigation means countries committing to carbon neutrality by mid-century and to concrete 2030 emissions reductions targets that will get us there, backed up with credible actions now. More ambition on finance means developing nations finally seeing the promised $100 billion a year for climate action, fully mobilizing the resources of both international financial institutions and the private sector too. And more ambition on adaptation means developed countries living up to their promise of credible support to developing countries to build resilience to save lives and livelihoods. And this means 50% of all climate finance provided by developed countries and multilateral development banks should be dedicated to adaptation. The African Development Bank set the bar in 2019 by allocating half of its climate finance to adaptation. Some donor countries have followed their lead. All must do so. My message to every member state is this: don't wait for others to make the first move. Do your part. Around the world, we see civil society led by young people fully mobilized to tackle the climate crisis. The private sector is increasingly stepping up. Governments must also summon the full force of their fiscal policy-making powers to make the shift to green economies. By taxing carbon and pollution instead of people's income, to more easily make switch to sustainable green jobs. By ending subsidies to fossil fuels and freeing up resources to invest back into healthcare, education, renewable energy, sustainable food systems and social protection for their people. By committing to no new coal plants. If all coal power plants become operational, we will not only be clearly above 1.5 degrees, we will be well above 2 degrees and the Paris targets will go up in smoke. This is a planetary emergency. We need coalitions of solidarity between countries that still depend heavily on coal and countries that have the financial and technical resources to support their transition. We have the opportunity and the obligation to act. Excellencies, third, we must bridge the gap between rich and poor, within and among countries. That starts by ending the pandemic for everyone, everywhere. We urgently need a global vaccination plan to at least double vaccine production and ensure that vaccines reach 70% of the world's population in the first half of 2022. This plan could be implemented by an emergency task force made up of present and potential vaccine producers, the World Health Organization, ACT accelerated partners and international financial institutions working with pharmaceutical companies. We have no time to lose. A lopsided recovery is deepening inequalities. Richer countries could reach pre-pandemic growth rates by the end of this year, while the impacts may last for years in low-income countries. Is it any wonder? Advanced economies are investing nearly 28% of their gross domestic product into economic recovery. For middle-income countries, that number falls to 6.5%. And it plummets to 1.8% for the least developed countries, a tiny percentage of a much smaller amount. In sub-Saharan Africa, the International Monetary Fund projects that cumulative economic growth per capita over the next 5 years will be 75% less than the rest of the world. Many countries need an urgent injection of liquidity. I welcome the issuance of 650 billion U.S. dollars in special drawing rights by the International Monetary Fund. But these SDRs are largely going to the countries that need them least. Advanced economies should reallocate their surplus SDRs to countries in need. SDRs are not a silver bullet, but they provide space for sustainable recovery and growth. I renew also my call for a reformed and more equitable international debt architecture. The debt service suspension initiative must be extended to 2022 and should be available to all highly indebted, vulnerable and middle-income countries that request it. This would be solidarity in action. Countries shouldn't have to choose between servicing debt and serving people. With effective international solidarity, it would be possible at the national level to forge a new social contract that includes universal health coverage and income protection, housing and decent work, quality education for all, and an end to discrimination and violence against women and girls. I call on countries to reform their tax systems and finally end tax evasion, money laundering, and illicit financial flows. And as we look ahead, we need a better system of prevention and preparedness for all major global risks. We must support the recommendations of the Independent Panel for Pandemic Preparedness and Response. I have put forward a number of other proposals in our common agenda, including an emergency platform and a futures lab. Mesdames et Messieurs.
Excellencies. Fourth, we must bridge the gender divide. COVID-19 exposed and amplified the world's most enduring injustice, the power imbalance between men and women. When the pandemic hit, women were the majority of frontline workers. They were the first to lose their jobs and first to put their careers on hold to care for those close to them. Girls were disproportionately hit by school closures that limit their development and increase the risk of abuse, violence, and child marriage. Bridging the gender divide is not only a matter of justice for women and girls. It is a game changer for humanity. Societies with more equal representation are more stable and peaceful. They have better health systems and more vibrant economies. Women's equality is essentially a question of power. We must urgently transform our male-dominated world and shift the balance of power to solve the most challenging problems of our age. And that means more women leaders in parliaments, cabinets, and boardrooms. It means women fully represented and making their full contribution everywhere. I urge governments, corporations, and other institutions to take bold steps, including benchmarks and quotas, to create gender parity from the leadership down. At the United Nations, we have achieved this among the senior management and our country team leaders. We will keep going until we have parity at every level. At the same time, we need to push back against regressive laws that institutionalize gender discrimination. Women rights are human rights. Economic recovery plans should focus on women, including through large-scale investments in the care economy. And we need an emergency plan to fight gender-based violence in every country. To achieve the Sustainable Development Goals and build a better world, we can and we must bridge the gender divide. Excellencies. Fifth, restoring trust and inspiring hope means bridging the digital divide. Half of humanity has no access to the internet. We must connect everyone by 2030. And this is a vision of my roadmap for digital cooperation, to embrace the promise of digital technology while protecting people from its perils. One of the greatest perils we face is the growing reach of digital platforms and the use and abuse of data. A vast library of information is being assembled about each one of us, and we don't even have the keys to that. We don't know how this information has been collected, by whom, or for what purposes. But we do know our data is being used commercially to boost corporate profits. Our behavior patterns are being commodified and sold like futures contracts. Our data is also being used to influence our perceptions and opinions. Governments and others can exploit it to control or manipulate people's behavior, to violating human rights of individuals or groups, and undermining democracy. This is not science fiction. It is science fact, and it requires a serious discussion. So too do other dangers in the digital frontier. I'm certain, for example, that any future major confrontation, and heaven forbid it should ever happen, will start with a massive cyber attack. Where are the legal frameworks to address this? Today, autonomous weapons can choose targets and kill people without human interference. They should be banned. But there's no consensus on how to regulate those technologies. To restore trust and inspire hope, we need to place human rights at the center of our efforts to ensure a safe, equitable, and open digital future for all.
Excellencies.
Excellencies, sixth and finally, we need to bridge the divide among generations. Young people will inherit the consequences of our decisions, good and bad. At the same time, we expect that 10.9 billion people will be born by century's end. We need their talents, their energies, their ideas. Our Common Agenda proposes a transforming education summit next year to address the learning crisis and expand opportunities for today's 1.8 billion young people. But young people need more than support. They need a seat at the table. And for this, I will appoint a special envoy for future generations and create the United Nations Youth Office. And the contributions of young people will be central to the Summit of the Future, as set out in our Common Agenda. Young people need a vision of hope for the future. Recent research showed that the majority of young people across 10 countries are suffering from high levels of anxiety and distress over the state of our planet. Some 60% of your future voters feel betrayed by their governments. We must prove to children and young people that despite the seriousness of the situation, the world does have a plan and that governments are committed to implementing it. We need to act now to bridge the great divides and save humanity and the planet.
With real engagement, we can live up to the promise of a better, more peaceful world. That is the driving force of our common agenda. The best way to advance the interests of one's own citizens is by advancing the interests of our common future. Interdependence is the logic of the 21st century, and it is the lodestar of the United Nations. This is our time, a moment for transformation, an era to reignite multilateralism, an age of possibilities. Let us restore trust, let us inspire hope, and let us start right now. Thank you.